Our next case is Flaherty versus the state of Minnesota. Counsel would approach. Each attorney will have 15 minutes for argument. The appellant will have additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I ask that each attorney identify themselves before they begin their presentation. The appellant may begin when ready.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Michael McLaughlin. I'm an attorney with the State Public Defender's Office, and I'm representing the appellant, Amy Flaherty, on this case. On the merits, the restitution award in this case cannot be justified. This court and the Minnesota Supreme Court has repeatedly held that for restitution, a restitution claim, the injury must be directly caused by the defendant's crime of conviction. In a case that just came out on July 17th, the Minnesota Supreme Court in Boettcher reaffirmed this principle that...
Both of us were on the Court of Appeals.
Yeah.
We're familiar with the case.
So I will file that. I'm intending to file that as supplemental authority as well after argument today.
So let's cut to the chase as far as I try to analyze this case. Even assuming you win on the merits, I don't know how we get there procedurally.
Okay.
And the reason I say that is I went back and I have the plea petition in front of me and then also the restitution hearing. And the plea petition at paragraph 21, I'm sure that you are familiar with, it says restitution, $1,400 J&S. I assume that's joint and several, but can have a restitution hearing. And then at the restitution hearing, Ms. Peterson, who was your client's counsel below, said Mr. Hemming, the assistant or the county attorney, refused to negotiate without the restitution included. So in order for her to plead guilty, she had to say she would agree to restitution, understanding she had the right to challenge the amount.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems like the restitution and the stay of adjudication were part and parcel of a single plea agreement. Can you help me understand your position with regard to that?
Looking at the plea petition, the record at the plea hearing, and the record at the sentencing hearing, it's evident that the party's consistent understanding was that they were agreeing to a restitution hearing. Ms. Flaherty never conceded any aspect of the restitution, and throughout this case, she challenged not just the amount, but the entire validity of restitution on the basis of the lack of causation. So while there was an agreement to a restitution hearing, there was no agreement to restitution. The understanding was that there would be an adversarial proceeding where the judge would make a decision on restitution. So our position is looking at, Coles, Evans, Lewis, the cases that have dealt with when a motion to correct sentence needs to be brought by a post-conviction petition. They're all concerned with a situation where the motion to correct sentence actually attacks the validity of the conviction. And in the Coles scenario, that happens.
That gets to the second part. Is there a conviction since it's a stay of adjudication?
Right. And it does, but it's sort of the argument you're raising here and the district court's reasoning sort of requires two steps. It needs to first find that this motion to correct sentence is actually a post-conviction petition because it undermines the validity of the conviction. So it had to be brought by post-conviction petition. And then because it's a post-conviction petition, since there's a stay of adjudication, can't reach the merits of the restitution claim. On that first point, it's our position that this was properly brought as a motion to correct sentence because her challenge to sentence did not in any way undermine the validity of the conviction. She didn't challenge the conviction, and her motion to correct sentence didn't give the state a basis to withdraw from the plea agreement. And that's because there was no agreement on the validity of restitution. All there was an agreement to an adversarial hearing.
Counsel, I just want to be sure I understand your argument. You're suggesting that the restitution was not a material part of the plea agreement because there wasn't an agreement as to how much?
Or that it was valid at all. Our position is all there was, looking at the record as a whole, there was only an agreement that there would be a contested restitution hearing. And that the process that the parties followed for that was to put in the plea agreement that there is restitution, but also make clear on the record that Ms. Flaherty intended to challenge that restitution.
But that's not what Ms. Peterson said below. She said, so in order for her to plead guilty, she had to say she would agree to restitution, understanding she had the right to challenge the amount. Not that she had the right to challenge restitution, period, but that she could challenge the amount of restitution.
But the Rule 2007 provides in that restitution challenge that the defendant can challenge more than just the amount, can challenge the validity of restitution on the basis that there isn't the causation.
I agree that the rule says that, but that's not what your client's counsel said.
Well, I think looking at the record as a whole, it was apparent that there was an intention to challenge the validity of the entire restitution. At sentencing, counsel stated that Ms. Flaherty doesn't feel restitution is appropriate under these circumstances. That's a broader statement than just the amount. The affidavit that was filed shortly after sentencing, it was clear that she was challenging the lack of causal connection. Looking at Coles, what Coles is concerned about is the idea of unfair surprise on the state, where a defendant reaches an agreement with the state that includes a sentencing component that the defendant later challenges on the basis that it's unlawful and that the state is caught off guard by that and denied the benefit of its plea bargain. Here, looking at the record, it's our position that the state entered this agreement with eyes open. It knew that this was going to go to a restitution hearing. It knew that the parties were going to argue their positions and the court would make a determination. The process that we're continuing today really started at the time of the plea, and it's been one continuation of Ms. Flaherty challenging restitution. So this isn't a situation like Coles where the state's been caught off guard and where it would be denied the benefit of its bargain. It knew what it was getting into. It knew that there would be a disputed proceeding. So based on that, it's our position that this motion to correct sentence doesn't challenge the validity of the conviction. It doesn't provide the state a basis to withdraw from the guilty plea.
Well, there isn't a conviction because it's a stay of adjudication.
Or not a conviction. That's true. It doesn't challenge the validity of the guilty plea, I guess would be the validity of the overall resolution in this case.
Mr. McLaughlin, I too am at a bit of a loss in understanding. If you look at the record, just saying one has a restitution hearing, of course, really isn't anything other than the law already provides. But I'm assuming what the trial court looked at and looks like inquired about that at the restitution hearing. The question I have is it seems to me that when you look at everything here and the stay of adjudication, that it's reasonable for the court to have found and conclude, and that's, I'm assuming, the respondent's position, and is that the respondent or the appellant had to give up that objection she had in order to get a stay of adjudication. And that the transcript that Judge Riley was referring to seems to jump out at me that Mr. Hemming refused to negotiate without the restitution included. So what I draw from that is in order for her to benefit from a stay of adjudication, she had to concede what, as you point out, all along she had been disagreeing with. That seems to be the picture that I see from looking at this record. Is there anything else that you can identify or point to that would suggest that wasn't critical to that discussion?
I think one aspect that's inconsistent with that reading of what the agreement was is what the district court considered at the restitution hearing. I mean, the district court considered the merits of the argument that there isn't a causal connection between the crime of conviction and the injury and the loss caused by disposing of the drum. So the district court, by what it allowed the parties to argue at the hearing, seemed to understand that there was no agreement that Ms. Flaherty would forego any aspect of restitution challenge, that she retained the right to challenge the underlying validity of the entire restitution claim as well as the specific amount. And she never made a challenge on the amount. The whole time this was all an argument based on this recovery or this disposal of this item had nothing to do with my crime of conviction, so I shouldn't get restitution. I shouldn't be assigned restitution. I agree that looking at statements in isolation may suggest otherwise, but looking at what the district court considered, what the witnesses testified to at the hearing, what Ms. Flaherty stated in her affidavit, this all the way through this case, this was about challenging the underlying validity of the restitution claim. It was all about the causation from the beginning. And the state knew that, and it still reached a plea agreement. I mean, I think the benefit of including it in the plea agreement was it procedurally set it up where restitution is on the table, and then Ms. Flaherty had to come in and challenge it. And I think there may have been some, and it made it more expeditious to do it that way rather than the state to, later make a restitution claim. I think they did it up front, but they did it with the understanding that this was going to be disputed, and this wasn't something Ms. Flaherty was going to concede, and that it was going to be up to the district court to make a decision after a contested hearing.
Counsel, I'm going to go back to the plea petition just for a minute. If this had said restitution on 1400 JNS and had no language of it, but can have a restitution hearing, would you agree that she couldn't properly bring her challenge under Rule 27?
Could you repeat that question? Just
well, if it said just restitution on 1400 JNS, period, mm-hmm. It didn't have, but can have a restitution hearing. That language wasn't there. Would you agree that she couldn't properly bring a Rule 27 motion then?
I would agree. Then part of the plea agreement would have been she agreed to restitution. So if she then challenged restitution after the fact, that would catch the state by surprise. It would deprive the state of a material benefit of the plea bargain that it thought it was receiving. So in that case, yes, under Evans and Coles, it would need to be brought by a post-conviction petition. And just one additional point, that even if this court concludes that this needed to be brought by post-conviction petition, it's our position that under this court should read DuPay not to apply to this situation. DuPay was, held that if there's a stay of adjudication of a conviction and sentence, a defendant cannot bring a post-conviction petition challenging that conviction and sentence. DuPay did not involve the situation here where there was a restitution order filed and imposed against Ms. Flaherty at the time of that July, after that July 2016 hearing. So, restitution is part of a sentence, and that aspect of Ms. Flaherty's sentence was imposed back in July 2016. So regardless of the fact that she got a stay of adjudication on other aspects of her sentence and that she got a stay of adjudication on the conviction, that restitution was still imposed. So DuPay should not be read to deprive her of her right to challenge that restitution award because the aspect of the sentence she's challenging was not stayed by the district court. So if the court does get that far where it finds that this had to be brought by post-conviction, it's our position that it should read DuPay not to apply to the scenario here. Otherwise, it would effectively close the courthouse doors for appeal or for post-conviction challenge of a defendant who's assigned an unlawful restitution award. And here, this is, I mean, if there's ever a case to sort of look to the substance, this case is one. Under Boettcher and for additional arguments that we go into detail in the brief, there's really no legal defense to assigning restitution in this case. She was convicted of possession. She wasn't convicted of sale or manufacture as a form of sale. She's convicted of possession, and she was charged restitution for the disposal of a drum with some type of chemical. So there's no reasonable reading where possession of marijuana was a but-for cause of the city's disposal of that drum. If she had been convicted of sale or manufacture, that might be a different scenario. But under Boettcher and other case law, you need to look at the crime of conviction, the conduct supporting the crime of conviction. Here, that was possession. So we're faced here with an unlawful restitution award, and we would just ask the court to get to the merits of that rather than relying on DuPay, which doesn't really fit the facts of this case, and correct what was an unlawful action by the district court in this case.
Counsel, I just have one question. That is, did it ever come out in the record why the appellant waited 2 years?
Part of that was a function of my workload and the public defender's workload. So, Ms. Flaherty, I would just ask the court not to hold that against Ms. Flaherty when considering the merits.
Okay. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel.
May it please the court. Good morning, counsel. Janine Putnam, Assistant Chisago County Attorney, appearing here today for David Hemming on behalf of the state. I would like to first note that it is the state's position that procedurally this challenge isn't properly before the court. I would note there is an argument in the reply brief and that appears to be made today that there's no opportunity for the appellant here to have challenged this restitution award. And I don't believe that's borne out in the record or under the law. Not only did she have that contested restitution hearing, but she could have filed a direct appeal within 90 days under Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure 2805, Subdivision 1, Paren 1. So although she did miss that deadline by a significant period of time, there was an opportunity there that she could have availed herself of. It is the state's position that the district court correctly concluded that a motion to correct sentence isn't appropriate here, and that restitution was a material part of this plea agreement. Counsel has argued here today that the challenge at the restitution hearing was the underlying validity as opposed to the amount. And I think under these facts, it's a little hard to make that assertion. There was only one item of restitution here. We weren't dealing with numerous items. And so in order to challenge that amount, which was clearly invoiced, appellant didn't have any option but to claim that it wasn't a valid restitution award. So I don't see here the difference between challenging a validity and challenging the amount. Additionally, I would note that when it comes to having challenged that amount, if the court reaches the merits here, the district court found the state's witness, the testimony of Chief Hoppe, to be more credible than appellant's testimony. She argued that this chemical had nothing to do with the significant amount of marijuana she possessed in her home, and Chief Hoppe testified that it was a chemical used in fertilizing marijuana grow operations. There's a lot of argument within the brief about the difference between potassium sulfate and potassium oleate. And I would note that in the CAT report where the chemical is referred to as potassium oleate, there's also a reference to potassium oleate being used as a fertilizer in marijuana grow operations.
I just have never seen a case where someone's been charged with cleanup, for instance, with a meth lab.
Well, Your Honor, I think that what the panel needs to look at is that this isn't actually, unlike as appellant has argued, this isn't actually a normal function of law enforcement activity. And I can't speak to the cleanup of meth labs. I haven't been exposed to a case where restitution has been sought, or I should say challenged with regard to cleanup of a meth lab.
I've never seen it ordered, and they fly in DEA hazmat units from Chicago, so I can only imagine what that bill would be like, and then getting rid of these toxic chemicals.
And again, Your Honor, I can't speak to the cleanup of a meth lab, but what I can speak to is that, as evidenced by the fact that the City of Wyoming and the Wyoming Police Department had to contract with a private agency, this was not something that is happening on a daily basis, something that's typically involved with, as is argued, execution of a search warrant.
Well, counsel, a cynic would suggest that what happened here was improper restitution in exchange for a stay of adjudication. In other words, you pay something that you know you don't have legally responsible for, and I'll go ahead with the stay of adjudication. I mean, that's one way to interpret this plea petition.
Well, and Your Honor, I would note that if that is where the panel comes out and the panel wants to analyze the merits of this restitution award, the state is still of the position that restitution should have been awarded here. The argument appears to be that appellant wasn't responsible or that the chemical wasn't related to the marijuana. Appellant doesn't actually seem to be arguing that she's not responsible for the chemical or even necessarily that the chemical could have been handled in another way. What she's arguing is that it wasn't related to the marijuana. And I think based on the fact that there was a significant amount of marijuana found in this home, along with grow operation materials, and we're talking about a commercial air scrubber, grow lights, and this barrel of fertilizer. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, a light in a closet. This was a significant amount of items indicating.
She didn't plead to manufacture, she pled to possession.
I understand that, Your Honor, but I think the argument that the association between possessing that amount of marijuana and the grow operation, the argument that that's too attenuated in order for restitution to apply, shouldn't be adopted by this panel. I don't think that based on these facts and based on what was in front of the district court, it would have been reasonable for the district court to conclude otherwise, and I don't believe it was an abuse of discretion for the court to conclude that it was related.
Arguably, however, the Supreme Court hadn't spoken at that point. I mean, they seemed to have made a direct cause more direct under the recent case law. So perhaps the court thought they were doing the right thing at the time, but it still may very well be improper restitution under the recent case law.
And again, Your Honor, I would just note that that's not the state's position. And with reference back, moving away from the merits of the case, with reference back to the procedural propriety here, I would like to address the argument regarding post-conviction relief. If the panel does determine that this was filed as a post-conviction petition, I do believe that the case law is clear. There's no conviction here, and pursuant to the clear language of Minnesota Statute Section 590.01, Subdivision 1, Paren 1, in order to file a petition for post-conviction relief, there does have to be a conviction. And so if we were in a situation where the stay had been revoked and a conviction had been entered, it may be possible to consider at that point the 2-year time frame for filing for post-conviction relief, but that's simply not where we are today.
Ms. Putman, is your primary agreement that it was not properly before the court because, as noted in the Evans case, the 2703 subdivision 9, which normally would apply, your position is that it doesn't apply because it affects the plea, the underlying conviction, the agreement itself?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, if that's the case, can you respond to the point that Mr. McLaughlin raised? Why did the judge then go into the facts as to the relationship of the liquid and the offense? If it clearly, which as I mentioned, Mr. McLaughlin, it does appear from all the written documents to have been critical part of the agreement to pay $1,400, the dollar amount's actually in there, and it fits pretty close to what was awarded. Why did the judge take evidence instead? The judge simply stopped. That's not relevant.
Your Honor, as I noted, I think that when we're looking at restitution and there's only one item of restitution with one amount, that the dispute, I mean, obviously got into that connection, but I don't believe that that indicated that the court believed or credited or found credible the appellant's argument that it wasn't related. The fact that there was testimony arguing that, I don't think changes the fact that the district court didn't credit that argument and found that restitution was appropriate. I agree that the record at the hearing was perhaps a bit more expansive than the state would have preferred. But I also wonder how an amount of restitution that's so clearly invoiced could have otherwise been challenged. And so although it is the county's or the state's position that this was a material part of the agreement, I do understand that the record sort of caused this argument to crop up. However, I don't think that changes the fact that this restitution was related to the offense, that the amount was appropriate, and that it wasn't an abuse of discretion for the court to conclude so.
Do you have a recommendation for prosecutors in light of, or both counsel in light of the recent Boettcher decision and the issue we're talking about here? How should the prosecutor, for instance, have identified the agreement as it relates to restitution?
Your Honor, I think ideally the amount should have been finalized prior to this agreement being entered. I do think that the procedural process here left room for this sort of argument, and I do believe that the agreement should have simply been instead of restitution in the amount of $1,400 subject to a challenge, it should have been a specific monetary amount. But I would note, you know, appellant's arguing here also that she couldn't afford to pay this amount, and ability to pay should have been considered. And I think that in setting the procedure up this way, the state was providing for that opportunity for that challenge. I don't think that the district court was incorrect in concluding that she could pay the restitution, but I do think in that way, the appellant's rights were being protected here by the way that this was worded. Whether that's ideal moving forward, likely not. Here we are. However, I would note that that is the state's position. And I would like to address for one moment briefly the ability to pay. With regard to that ability to pay, the district court is, of course, required to consider that, but is not required to make any specific findings. It's noted that the issue of her financial abilities, her resources, her assets, was addressed both in the PSI and at the sentencing hearing, and the state's position is that that was an adequate consideration. I would note that appellant was ordered to pay $1,413.45 over the course of a 60-month probationary period. The district court clearly felt she had the ability to make that payment, and there isn't an indication that that was an abuse of discretion. Additionally, I would note that victims do have a right to be compensated, and the city of Wyoming, despite being a governmental entity, does qualify as a victim and can qualify as a victim. With regard also to the argument that the city is somehow double recovering for having received this order for restitution, there was an argument in the brief that the costs for the city should have been satisfied in the fine and surcharge. The state doesn't agree with that. But in addition, this was a $575 fine and surcharge. So even if it provided an offset, like a civil settlement, it wouldn't have satisfied the entire restitution amount and shouldn't be considered to have done so. Other than that, unless the panel has additional questions.
No, counsel, thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Mr. McLaughlin, we have Judge Rancourt who took the plea and then who sentenced and then who did the restitution hearing.
Yep.
And he asked questions during that about what the material terms of the plea were. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in the conclusions of law, maybe it's a finding of fact, but he calls it a conclusion of law, that the payment of restitution was a material part of defendant's plea. Because it was the same judge on each of those proceedings, what do you think, does that have bearing on that finding or that conclusion of law, since he was presiding over everything?
Any conclusion of, I think the fact that he was the same judge all the way through doesn't necessarily affect the standard of review. It's still reviewed for abuse of discretion, and a court abuses of discretion if the court misapplies the law. And it's our position that's what he did here. And again, we would just point to what Judge Rancourt did throughout this proceeding, which was consider all the restitution arguments available, including the underlying validity of the entire restitution award. So we'd ask the court to really focus on that when looking at Judge Rancourt. And then I think the state respondent said something significant, that, you know, because there was just one lump sum here that was claimed as restitution, it was sort of an all or nothing, and that, you know, if she was going to challenge the amount, she was going to challenge the entire amount. What that shows in our view is that there was no agreement to anything for restitution, because the state knew that by challenging restitution, Ms. Flaherty was going to challenge it all, and it could walk away with this with getting nothing and getting no restitution claim. So I think the fact that they were challenging the amount expressly in the plea petition, and the state has conceded that by challenging the amount, they were challenging the whole restitution award, that shows that the state had eyes open. It knew that there was no agreement to restitution, that it was at risk of walking away with nothing after this restitution hearing. So we are in a situation where there was no agreement. The state is not deprived of the benefit of the bargain by this restitution challenge. This is exactly what the state knew it was getting into when it reached this agreement with Ms. Flaherty. And then one other point that I didn't address that I wanted just to cover briefly was just another aspect why this restitution award in our view was improper, and that's because This was a joint and several case where there were two co-defendants, and there's absolutely no evidence offered by the state that Ms. Flaherty in particular was the defendant who was responsible for this drum. And that's another deficiency and another way in which the state failed to meet its burden. So I just wanted to state that as well. And you know, it's true Ms. Flaherty did not file a direct appeal in this case, but this court has also held that, and the Minnesota Supreme Court's held that there is a basic constitutional value in Minnesota that a defendant has one right of review. And she didn't file a direct appeal, but she still has not had any review of her restitution challenge. So based on that, we would ask the court to get to the substance of this case, correct an error that, if that at least after Boettcher is at least a plain error of law that occurred in this case, and find that the restitution award was unlawfully imposed here. And then,
if we were to send it back, wouldn't we send it back so she could decide if she's going to withdraw her plea and start all over again?
I mean, Ms. Flair did not ask to withdraw her plea. I mean, she asked to just remove the restitution award from her sentence. So, you know, that if the state or if this court finds that restitution is invalid, the state could conceivably move to withdraw from the plea. Yet. But and under Coles, that you know. That it could argue that under Coles it's entitled to withdraw from the plea, but Ms. Flaherty would have no intention of withdrawing from the plea agreement. She just
doesn't want to.
Right? No, it's true. But I mean, as far as the exchange that occurred in this case, I would also just note that the record doesn't necessarily show that this was a situation where the state got restitution and in exchange gave a stay of adjudication. She was initially charged with fifth-degree possession. She has really no criminal record before this case. So it's the type of case that would fit well into a stay of adjudication, regardless of the restitution issue. And, you know, we would just ask the court to apply Boettcher and find that that the restitution should not have been imposed in this case.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McLaughlin. Ms. Putnam, the matter will be taken under advisement, and a decision will issue within 90 days.